Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Fleur and Julia. Fleur is a mum of two wonderful daughters. She is passionate about learning about supporting her daughter through anorexia recovery with as much kindness and compassion as possible. Supported by CAMHS, she has used non-violent resistance as a response to the eating disorder and has seen the power it has to nurture the parent-child relationship and to allow the child to feel able to find their place in the family instead of retreating to the eating disorder. The MVR principles are grounded in the idea that you are only able to control your own behaviour and that to do this you require regular self-care. Fleur is passionate about making something positive out of something so difficult. Joining Fleur in today's episode is Julie. Julie is a family therapist working in a child and adolescent mental health service within the eating disorder team. Julie has a passion for the ideas of NVR. Since attending a conference in 2011 and being inspired by parents' stories, Julie has been using the ideas with families within the CAMHS service. Julie has found that NVR has guided her both as a parent and a therapist and can see how useful the NVR ideas are for those supporting a loved one with an eating disorder. I so enjoyed this episode with Fleur and Julie, and it was really lovely to have the representation of both a parent who has been through this and also a therapist. I know that for me and my family, having the NVR principles would have actually been something that would have been so useful. So really hope that this episode is insightful for you and gives you some ideas and helps you to realise that in no way, shape or form, if your loved one is struggling with an eating disorder, is it your fault or is it your responsibility to fix them? But actually coming alongside them and working on this together is what's important.
Well, thank you both so much for joining me on the podcast today. It is, I always love it when I have two guests because it's even more talking to happen. So it is really, really lovely to have you both. And did you just want to introduce yourself for the listeners today?
I'm Fleur, and I am a mum who has lots of lived experience of living with a daughter who has anorexia. And so I'm here because I'm fascinated in thinking about how we can better support her through the use of NVR in a way that means that we have a lot of family connection and happy family despite all the problems that might come from an eating disorder.
And my name's Julie, and I'm a family therapist who's currently working within a CAMHS eating disorders service. And I've had the privilege of working alongside her over the last year, but now it's a year now.
Oh, amazing. And how did you guys meet?
Fleur was invited to be part of our NVR parent programme. And so we met during the parent program. I was facilitated with colleagues, and was part of the group.
Yeah, I think for me it was one of those moments where we were already very well supported by CAMHS as a team, and when they offered an NVR course to us, I couldn't quite believe it. I sort of got to the room, looked around, and thought there were more people that care enough to look after us and really want the best for my family and my daughter. That's just amazing. And it was also a room full of people who were just like me, having the same sorts of worries and struggles, and who were desperate to help their child. And then there was all this support. So we were very lucky to have Julie. It was her baby, really.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. And I think, you know, it's one of those things. I know you and I, we spoke before, in that, you know, when you're going through an eating disorder, often, you know, loved ones cannot have access to support, and actually it's so important that they do. And you've mentioned it a couple of times, and it is the topic of our conversation today, but you've mentioned NVR, and I wondered for the listeners, if they're thinking, what on earth is NVR, would you mind just explaining, you know, what that means for you?
NVR stands for non-violent resistance. And it's a intervention, it's a parent-only intervention. It was developed by a psychologist called Jaime Mayer, probably maybe 20, 25 years ago now. And he took the ideas from the social political movements of Gandhi and Martin Luther King, and thought that actually these ideas of the political movement would be really helpful for parents who were managing, at the time, violence and aggression. And then over the years, what's happened is that NBR's developed, and we're now using it within our CAM service, and then we're now using it within our eating disorder service. And I suppose the principles of NBR really are around resisting non-violently. Quite often the kind of the title of non-violent resistance puts people off, and they say, you know, well, my child's not violent, so why would I want to do something like that? But actually what we do know when we see distress in young people is that situations escalate, and there might not necessarily be violence, but there's certainly disconnection really. And the NBR principles, I think, are really straightforward principles. They're around, how do you become very present in your child's life? How do you look after yourself in order to de-escalate? How do you reconnect and rebuild relationships? Who are your supporters, and what does your support system look like? What's it like for you to be able to ask for help? It also helps us think about actually prioritising behaviours. And then when all of this is kind of thought about and put into place, then we begin to think about, how do we then communicate this to our young people? And NBR uses the idea of an announcement, be that an announcement to yourself to let yourself off the hook, but actually then also to announce it to your child, this is what I'm doing, this is what we'd like you to do, and these are the reasons why. And I think that kind of NBR gives you a script for life, really. As a parent, I think it gives you a script for life, because we're always going to be parents, whether our children are small or older. You know, I think I've learned that, you know, as my children have got older and they've reached adulthood, actually it's strength and wisdom that they need. And so NBR, I think, is kind of an intervention that is for life, really. And it gives you a very practical way of just doing it when you're feeling quite lost, I think.
Definitely. Julie said to me last week, actually, about the idea that NBR allows you to be the parent that you always wanted to be and that you always chose and hoped you would be, but that actually sometimes things like an eating disorder or concerns in life can mean that actually you don't get to parent in the way you want to parent, and going back to NBR allows you to do that. So I think that was a really nice way of putting it.
I think you're really right. And from my perspective, when you first came to me and, you know, you spoke about it, I was a bit like, oh my gosh, like, you know, why are they talking about violence and things like that? But actually, it's when we then spoke, Flair, about it in more detail, I was like, this makes so much sense, because, you know, I think that often when, particularly with an eating disorder, it was almost like another person almost comes into your life and separates you. You know, if we're speaking about young people with eating disorders, you know, you from maybe your parents, or if you're an adult, maybe from your relationship or your partner or your friends. And it, from my experience anyway, was very sort of seductive, and, you know, would tell me they're telling you to do that thing because they don't like you, or because they want you to be in harm's way, when actually that's what the eating disorder is doing. But to have that conversation with somebody when they are so, you know, and I mean this in the best way, but like manipulated almost by their eating disorder, it's difficult to then have those conversations. I think, like you both said, you know, having that script of how to have those conversations sounds, you know, incredible. To almost, I guess, as well, when you're a parent or a loved one of somebody struggling with an eating disorder, you have no training in how to support someone with an eating disorder. And it almost, I guess, I don't know whether you found this, Flair, can I give you like, confidence of like, okay, this is what I'm being told to do, therefore it's okay to do, rather than like, my child's got an eating disorder and I have no idea of how to even start a conversation with them.
Definitely. And in lots of ways, it was not really talking about the eating disorder with my daughter. It was actually more about, how do I make this relationship come back? Because exactly what you said, she sort of disappeared off to her bedroom to the eating disorder. And actually building any connection with her was really difficult. You know, we had quite a significant amount of time where I really couldn't get her to speak to me in more than grunts.
And my daughter has autism as well. And we'd already sort of reparented or reworked out how to parent in a way that wasn't this sort of black and white confrontational way with her. We'd gone much more about coming alongside her anyway as a parent. And it's sort of when I think about not putting too many demands on her, we'd already gone to that place. But this was a whole new level of parenting where actually all of your values as a parent seem to be being tested. So if you are getting the sort of aggressive behaviour that sometimes does come with anorexia, so shouting and swearing and sort of being verbally aggressive, maybe throwing things with frustration, you know, how do I manage that? What am I supposed to do? Because that puts, and we've talked a lot about this with myself and Julie actually, but it puts the child as in fight and flight, but then you go into fight and flight as well. So how do I deal with that? What do I do to prevent me going into fight and flight when they are going into it? And what do I do to mean that actually they can come out of that fight or flight and then we can deal with whatever is causing that distress? And so MBR gives you that principle. So it talks about connecting before you make any corrections in behaviour. And I think that was quite powerful. So holding feelings of the distress, being able to think. And often, of course, with anorexia, it's around mealtimes that you tend to get a lot of those fight or flight moments because you're saying you need to do this, and that's the last thing that person wants to do. It's the hardest thing that you're asking them to do. So actually they're going to feel distress. And your value is, I don't want my child to die at that point. You know, I want to keep my child alive. And if you don't eat, you could potentially be at risk of dying. And so actually, how do I manage those feelings? How do I manage that emotion? And it gives you a lot of skills for thinking about preparing yourself for that. And getting yourself ready for those moments. And then actually, how do you stay connected to your child when you've had those moments? So at the end of a meal, for example, they might storm off, they might be upset. What do I do with that? How do I make sure they know that we're still okay, our relationship is not broken now? And one of the things as a group that we thought about was, where does everybody go when you've had those moments? And the fact that actually often people will go and hide in their rooms and look at their phones. And if you're somebody with an eating disorder, you might go and scroll on things that are actually going to make it harder for you. So how do you say to your child, you know what, okay, we've had that moment, but we're still friends. It's still okay. We still love each other. So thinking about just little comments that you might say and things that you might use to make sure they know that they're still loved by you, even though these things are hard and distressing. And for me, that was really, really powerful. So I could manage my own self more. I could manage me not going into fight or flight as much. And also I knew that she knew she was loved even in those moments of stress. And also when I wasn't there, when she was at school and having those moments of stress, how can I make sure she knows I've been thinking about her in the day? A recent example was I said to her, I sent you a message. I didn't. I checked my phone at a time when I know it's stressful for you. It was a lesson that was stressful. I said, check my phone to see if you'd sent me a message. And she just went, oh, I don't. Just the fact that she knew that I've been thinking about her, and that's what we always talked about was how do you show that connection? How do they know that you're still connected to them even when you're not together?
I think just listening to you say that, it makes me think about MBR. For me, I always think about MBR as a bit like building a house, and that the foundations of the house are around self-care. So in order to be able to kind of de-escalate and manage and co-regulate the emotions of the mother, you've got to be able to regulate your own emotions. And if you're not looking after yourself, then that makes it so much harder, because actually you need to be looking after yourself in order to be able to regulate your own emotion, to regulate a mother. And so for me, the foundation is around self-care, but it's also around this idea of what they call, NDR would call it, reconciliation gestures, which are gestures that actually are unconditional gestures that are like, that are used in an attempt to rebuild and reconnect with another. So they're unconditional gestures, really. And it was really interesting what you were saying, Hannah, about actually when you're struggling with an eating disorder and you're absorbed by the illness. I often think it's a bit like if you were to hold a piece of paper in front of you. What does it do? It blocks the other person, doesn't it? So all I can see is the illness, all you can see is the illness. And MVR has a really clever way of shifting the illness
so that you can see behind it to the daughter or the son, to the person that's being affected. So you begin to understand what they need. And I think that reconciliation gestures do this. They shift the illness out of the way. They offer a sense of reconnection. And then those ideas around learning, how do you de-escalate? But what does escalation look like in your house? Whether you join in, whether you give in. We hear so many times, don't we, stories of families that are like walking on eggshells, which brings a horrible atmosphere into the house. That actually, I want to say something, but I can't. So we talk a lot about the ideas of de-escalation. And it goes with that idea that whatever we can make conscious, we can change. So we get families to actually really think about themselves in this work, really. So they begin to recognise what happens to you when you start to escalate, because everybody is very different. But it also thinks about this idea of how do you remain present in your child's life. So like you said, Fleur, how does my child know that I'm thinking of them even when I'm not with them? Because in order to be a safety net for our children, they've got to be able to know what we're thinking when we're not with them, because that actually gives them a sense of what's right or wrong. They may then decide to do something very different, but that doesn't matter. That their first thought might be, and I'm sure we've all done it, you know, God, if my mum knew that I was doing this, she would kill me. Because actually, your mum is very present in your mind, and you know what she says is right and wrong.
Yeah.
And so I think that if we lay the foundations of self-care and reconciliation gestures, we build the walls of de-escalation, parental presence, bringing in our supporters, because like we've talked about before, that when you've got a child with an eating disorder, what we recognise is that support disappears, partly because of the longevity of the illness, but partly because we stop asking people to the house for fear of what they might say, because actually they might make it worse. Sometimes in our service, we have to take children out of school, which means that support diminishes further. And so building a support system is a really valuable part of the MBR process.
Yeah.
And then thinking about how you prioritise behaviours, how you choose what you're focusing on. So I think about it in terms of building a house, and that over time we do it, don't we? We do that over time. I was asking Fleur earlier that if she were to talk to a friend about, explain to a friend what MBR is, what would you say to a friend?
For me, I always try and explain it in this way. About, I always say it's like Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, and that quiet resistance, that kind of peaceful resistance. But I think really for me, and it's a really odd thing to say, I don't know if I can say it really, it's one of those that actually the eating disorder, because of MBR, has actually given me a better relationship with my child than I think I might have had otherwise. And it is about building that real connection, that I would be the first person that she would come to, and she would think, I need to talk to mum about this, and not I need to retreat to my phone or wherever it might be, or you know. And I think so, it is, she knows that she can trust me completely, that she feels safe and secure, that I'm the person that she can
trust. And I think that when you've got a child with an eating disorder, actually you have to be more present than the eating disorder, so your voice has to be louder than the eating disorder voice, not in a shouty way, but in a way that says, no, I'm here, I know what needs to happen, this is what we need to do.
You can trust me.
I think it's, I can really relate to what you were saying, Fleur, there about you having a deeper connection now with your daughter because of what you've been through. And it feels weird, doesn't it, to say, you know, not that you're grateful, but almost, you know, you kind of are, because you wouldn't have had that relationship. And I definitely think about that with my relationship with myself, in that I have spent so long in recovery, you know, digging deeper, finding more about myself. Everyone always says to me now, God, you're so self-aware. And maybe I wouldn't have been if I hadn't. So, you know, you've always got to look on the bright side of things. But I think, you know, what you were saying there about the principles of MVR and stuff is so, so important. And, you know, just speaking from my experience, I think one of the biggest things when I was a teenager and had an eating disorder was that sense of that my parents had that sense of real guilt and shame. And, you know, as you were saying, Julie, you know, you stop maybe inviting people round, you stop maybe going out. And I know for my mum, a real difficulty was everyone could visibly see that I was poorly and that I was ill. And so if my mum did go out with their friends, they'd just ask, how's Hannah? They wouldn't say, how are you? It'd be, how's Hannah doing? Mm. And I think that for my parents, naturally, they felt quite a lot of frustration towards that, because the eating disorder does take over your life, because it's such a core part. And I really liked your visualization there, Julie, with the paper. And my partner said something really that struck me once. He was like, I feel like I'm in a three-person relationship, because whatever we do, wherever we go, eating disorder's with us. And he was like, every time I feel like I'm talking to you, the eating disorder is sat there, the eating disorder's almost responding to you. And I guess my question, following on from what you've said, is, you know, I think in principle it sounds fantastic, and I'm sure over time, you know, you do build those mechanisms and you get better at it. But do you know, sometimes people just really piss you off when they do things, and especially when in people are in recovery, it's like, why are you doing this to yourself? Why are you doing this to us? So how did NVR help you in those moments when you just, like, you know, want to slam your head against a wall and say, for God's sake, just get better? And I mean that obviously in the nicest way, with so much sympathy, and hopefully the listeners will know that I am not just saying, for God's sake, just eat your dinner, because I know it's not that easy. But sometimes when you're helping someone, you can get those frustrations and think, you know, you're not just impacting your life, you're impacting my life and our family's life.
I completely understand, and I still have those moments sometimes, you know. It would be a lie to say I didn't have those moments where I go, you know, come on, I've had enough of this now. Surely you've had enough of this now. We all need to move on. But I think it's being able to find real value in the kind of routine. It sounds bizarre, but, you know, when I'm supporting a snack or a meal, I'm able now to mostly not always, but nearly always say to myself, do you know what? I'm really lucky I've got this time with my child. I wouldn't have had this time otherwise. And because of NVR and all the connection that's built, I actually really mostly enjoy those times. We have really good chats. And I wouldn't have had that opportunity otherwise. So it's because of those things that are in place. And that doesn't mean that sometimes the anorexia isn't louder and I'm less patient and I've got less space to be understanding, because sometimes that happens together. And, you know, we'll both be going, why are you crossing me? Why are you crossing me? But actually, most of the time, we look forward to those moments together. And so I think it's changing that viewpoint. Mm. The other thing that I think really shifted for me was not seeing the things that might have irritated me as they're doing it wrong, and then, you know, they need to sort this out. So if I found, like, hidden food, for example, not thinking, oh, they're doing that on purpose, you know, they need to sort it out, they need to get better at it. Actually, to say, this is a cry for help. This is my child saying to me, I can't do this on my own, and that's why I've left this for you to find, or why I've done it in public. If I'm struggling with over-exercising, I've done it in a public space in the house, you know, I'm saying help. I'm not trying to be annoying or trying to be difficult. So it was reframing, really.
I suppose I was just thinking that I remember from the work that we did together that at the very beginning, there was something really important about the importance of self-care, and that before every meal or every snack, you prepared yourself.
Yeah.
And so you got yourself a nice glass.
Yeah.
To have a nice drink.
Yeah.
And then actually, I was also thinking that Julie taught us in NVR the cycle of the supportive meal, and this is a really useful tool. So when you're preparing for supporting your child with a meal or a snack, you worry about it being stressful. You know, I would often feel a lot of tension and stress in my body, and I'd be thinking, oh God, I've got to get this fast, I've got to do this, I've got to make sure it's right, cut it up in the right sizes, and all the other things that worry you, you know. And this was actually about, well, how do I ground those feelings?
Yeah, yeah.
So having a nice drink prepared, putting yourself first at the start, and we talk about self-care, it could be a spa day, but it literally could be a better mug, couldn't it? Or a wine glass to put your squash in, or whatever, put some ice in your squash, whatever it is you've chosen to, maybe wine.
But how you then manage your emotions before you start that support.
So that's what I was thinking. I was thinking actually you were really good at actually getting a nice glass in order to have a drink with. So you were preparing yourself for the meal or the snack that was coming, weren't you? You were thinking about actually, you know, that idea about the only person that you can change is yourself is a really important one, isn't it? And when we kind of go into any situation, if we go into a situation prepared for that situation, then the outcome is usually better, isn't it? Than if we go in and we're flying in at the end of the day and you've had a busy day, you've not had a drink all day, and now you've got to sit and watch somebody have a snack. You're going to be a different kind of parent than the one that actually has spent just 5 minutes thinking about it, preparing yourself, pouring themselves a drink and going into it. And I think sometimes I think MDR is so simple and yet it's so powerful because it just asks, what am I doing? Am I okay? What do I need? How am I going to manage the next 20 minutes? And I think that you were really good at doing that. You were really good at doing that.
I think I've been thinking about the things that might happen during a meal. So, you know, if you think about how do I not get annoyed? Well, what are the things that are likely to be a problem? So I'm going to have some stock phrases, like if a portion size is questioned, for example, I'm going to say, it's okay, you can trust me, I've looked at the meal and I know what's meant to be there on the plate, you're fine. And being prepared for things that you can say, and then also knowing that those moments of stress at the end, that you will resolve them. So one of the things that we would always do is ask my daughter to get stuff from the table. We always say something like, I think it's been really lovely spending dinner with you, you know, however stressful it might have felt, and love you, you know, so that you know you've got that sort of plan ahead of you and they know that it's okay, you know, whatever's happening. I think that helps you as well manage those things.
Yeah, I love that idea of, and I think, you know, this both for the person supporting with the meal and for the person, you know, having the difficult meal, bringing yourself to the table in a calm and, you know, a calm manner, whether that is, you know, maybe doing some deep breathing before you turn up or, you know, different things like that. Because if you're super stressed beforehand, then you sit down and then, you know, something's slightly out of place or whatever, that's only going to exacerbate that stress. So I really like that kind of, you know, putting yourself in a better place before you sit down. Obviously, it's going to be anxiety provoking and it's going to be difficult. But also something I try and say to myself is the more that I do it, the easier it gets. So, you know, something that a couple of months ago was so incredibly difficult, I could now do with my eyes closed and not even bothered about it. But it's difficult at that starting point to kind of know, actually, this is going to get easier for me. And something else I wanted to ask you about, because I think we spoke about this bit when we chatted there, is your support system external to your household and how you looked after yourself. Because I think one thing I hear so much from people that are supporting a loved one with an eating disorder is, and you know, this is nobody's fault, I think it's in the nature of the eating disorder, but life becomes encapsulated by the eating disorder. So, you know, if you're going out for a family day out, you'll plan it around maybe what the eating disorder would find comfortable, or, you know, maybe you're not seeing your friends because you're always supporting a loved one, or, you know, your enjoyment of life is kind of zapped. And kind of what was your perspective about that? Did you try and keep things within, you know, your life still kind of semi-normal, or did you fully focus on your eating at your daughter's recovery?
I mean, at first, absolutely what you said, I felt like all the curtains came down, literally came down, and the doors closed, and it was very dark and very quiet and quite isolated and lonely. And although you've got, and we have the support of immediate family, it's still limited in what they can do and what they can offer, and they can sort of offer emotional offloading, and that's about it really, because you feel that the care is so bespoke, it's only the immediate people supporting the person that are able to do it. You know, you don't feel like you can trust or make put that on other people really. But one of the real benefits of MBR is the group that we've then worked with. So we have the support of the team, but we also have the support of the other parents that are there as well. So all of a sudden I've got 8 new friends that are going through the same thing and completely understand it, and I'm able to sort of say to them, help, this has just happened. What do I do about it? And somebody would know. Somebody would have that experience or be able to just say, I've been through that myself. Don't worry, it will pass. And often offer amazing advice. You know, I messaged one yesterday saying, I've got this idea. And she was like, yeah, run it past Julie when you see her. But she did give me brilliant advice as well. And I think it's that connection. You're suddenly not alone. You've suddenly got other parents that totally understand the hardest moments. You know, because I think we talked about the sort of trauma that the whole family experiences, mm-hmm. didn't we? But I also, because of the sort of aggression that came alongside things, and there was a threat of physical violence, really, I pulled in some of my close community. So I asked for some of the neighbours, some of the teachers that had worked with the family and were friends with the family to support as well. And that was before the MBR group came into place. And that was something I'd really recommend. I feel that when there's a threat of violence or violence in the home, if you're afraid of saying it out loud, you know, you don't want to share every time with people that might be something that might happen. You're embarrassed that this could happen. But likewise, if you keep it secret, it's so much more likely to happen again. Mm-hmm. And so something that I thought was really helpful was to ask these people to be supporters of the family, but particularly the child, my daughter, and to say, if something had happened, I would let them know. And she knew that they would know, and it was never going to be a negative thing. It was always going to be, Mum said this has been a difficult day, you know, I'm here, do you want to go for a walk, got the dogs, bring them round, or let's have a chat, you know, we'll send some nice texts. So some family that were further away would just do nice texts, you know, I'm always here, what are you thinking of you? So it was not about criticising those moments. It was about going, this must be really hard. If this is what's happening, this is tough. So how can we support you?
I suppose what I was thinking is that what Phil was just describing was really important, because I think that gathering your supporters around you and having one back for your daughter, it wasn't about shaming the child in terms of, oh, Mum's told me this, and oh, you know, why have you done that again? It was about, actually, Mum's told me this. It sounds like things are really tough at the moment. I'm here if you need me for something. So it wasn't about shaming the child. It was about, actually, how do we offer support to the whole family, child included, really. And I often say that within the MBR process, what we find is that the family, you will have a number of people that know you and care about you, that can see that things are hard, but maybe don't know what to do. And so the idea of getting support and asking your supporters for help, it isn't a open-ended request. It's something very specific, and it's offered to them so they can then say yes or no. Mm-hmm. And I think you were really good at that. You were really good at thinking, actually, who have I got around me? Mm-hmm. What can I ask them to do? And what does support look like? Because support might look like somebody who's just going to text your daughter.
Yeah.
But support could also be somebody that picks them up from school, but it could also be somebody who just says, come for a coffee and you have a laugh. So support comes in so many forms, really, that I think that what you've said is just really important, that it's not about showing the young person, it's about actually saying, it sounds like life is really tough. And for the supporters, we all know, don't we, that if we're asked by somebody to help them, that we're given the option of saying yes or no, then most of us are more than happy to say yes. If we can do that, then we'll do it. And I think that when you begin to think about the importance of looking after yourself, if you can give, then you should be able to receive, and then you should also be able to help to look after yourself as well. But so many people find that really hard.
It made me think about when I've had friends who have needed support. And you put out that message, don't you, when you say, you know, let me know if there's anything I can do to help. But it's too general. And when you're in a really difficult place, can't think to ask, what do I need help with? You know, so I learning from MBR, when I had recently had a friend that needed help, I said, I will pick your child up every Monday. I can offer you that. So actually almost thinking of the person that is going to offer the help, what have I got capacity for to help? What can I do that will be the help? And I think that's better, isn't it?
Yeah.
I cannot be some, I might just be the person who texts, but I can do that.
That's literally exactly what I was thinking as you were both talking, was I love the fact of, because I know that we had a very similar experience, and I think a lot of people do when you're struggling, whether that's physically ill or mentally ill or, you know, whatever's going on, people will text you and they say, oh, let me know if I can help. And that is honest, that, you know, that's so lovely. And it's really kind when people say that. But when you're in that vulnerable position, even if someone said, oh, let me know if there's anything I can do that I can will help, you're still like, oh, I don't know whether I should ask, like, is it okay to ask? But then if you've got things that you can actually say to people, you know, like, oh, you know, could you text my daughter once a week or what have you, then that actually gives somebody something that you specifically asked for, and also they won't feel like they're treading on toes. And I think so often with eating disorders, the biggest kind of difficulty for people that haven't had their own experience is, I'm so worried I'm going to say the wrong thing, or what if I say something that upsets somebody? So knowing that, oh, well, if I, you know, bring my dog round so that they can have a cuddle with my dog, then that's going to really cheer them up, and that can be my role, and I don't have to worry that I'm going to say the wrong thing. I do that I have two Siberian kittens, and I just always say to people if they're feeling sad, I'm like, just come round and see the cats, because I know that will cheer people up. I'm like, that's a good thing to suggest. But one thing I wanted to ask, because I know in my experience, even with the best will in the world, you know, when I got diagnosed with anorexia, my mum and dad went and did the research. My mum attended like a BEAT course and she wanted to learn lots about it. But if it's not something that's directly in your family, I think that there's still a lot of stigmas and stereotypes out there about eating disorders. And particularly if you bring in the aggression and maybe the violence, people can then kind of maybe misunderstand, or maybe, this is a silly example, but you know, if you've had an argument, like I'd have had an argument with my mum, let's say, and she's really annoyed me, but then if somebody that's outside of my family unit then says a bad word about my mum, I'd be like, what the hell are you saying? That's my mum you're talking about. Even though I've just had a massive argument, I've been moaning about her. And I think, you know, I had experiences where my like wider family would maybe say, oh, well, why isn't Hannah just getting better? Or God, has she turned into an aggravated teenager? Or, you know, what's going on with her? How did you manage those conversations with friends and family if they didn't really understand and were being quite negative towards your daughter?
I think the hardest thing I experienced was the conversations that happen around you and your child when you're doing your very best to protect them from things that might be triggering. And I found that the most difficult. It's almost like the elephant in the room, isn't it? The more you think you shouldn't talk about food or energy in food or exercise, everybody wants to talk about those things. And I think that is really tricky, because I mean, I've listened to your podcast before, Hannah, and it gave me inspiration for what to do actually with this, because it was that thing about, I can't police everybody in the world. I can't police people in shops who say really random things to me about the amount of calories in foods that I don't know why they're telling me this. I'm not interested. And my daughter is there. And sometimes it's just a case of biting your tongue, isn't it? And thinking, do you know what? We're in a place that we can cope with this. And sometimes it's about having those hard conversations. And I am really lucky, because Cam's regularly will support me with those conversations, and I'll say like, I'm worried about this, and get that support on how to phrase things. And if it's like a Christmas day, my MBR team group friends are going to help me with that, because we're all pinging to each other on the WhatsApp saying, oh, what do we do about this now?
Yeah, I was just going to say that in terms of when we were thinking about the MBR work, and we were thinking about actually who supports you also then begin to think about, what is it that you appreciate about the support that they offer? So what kind of support do they offer?
Yeah.
But it also makes us think about when our supporters are not supportive. And it's okay to kind of acknowledge that sometimes support can be unsupportive. So you might get somebody who's in your support system who probably says the wrong thing all of the time, but actually is quite happy to put your bins out on a Tuesday. Yeah. And so, you know, you give them that job, don't you, of putting the bins out on a Tuesday, because you've got other people that can actually step in and do a different kind of support. So I think that when we think about supporters, it's certainly not, from an NBR perspective, it's not an open-ended request. But it's also okay to think about the people that are supporting you and how they support you and how you want them to support you. Because that can, it's okay to say that, you know, you're great at doing this, but actually I don't need you to do that.
And I think as well, it's that even with an eating disorder where to many people you'd be able to see the eating disorder, still many people don't see it. You know, however ill somebody gets, they don't tend to see there's an eating disorder there. And I think one of the things that I found tricky is managing, you've got a hidden disability with autism anyway, and then you've got this sort of hidden mental illness as well, that even though it impacts you physically, it doesn't impact physically enough for you to be so ill that somebody would go, oh, when they saw you. And so therefore I found that battle difficult in sort of getting support with things like school support, with things and thinking about making people aware of what was happening, because it is in many ways often hidden, isn't it? You know, even under baggy jumpers and things. So
yeah, I have very particular memories in my brains of where people have not quite said the right thing, or very much not said the right thing, and my mum's just sat there like with her head in her hands, like, oh my god, how's Hannah going to respond? And you know, at the start it would be Hannah would absolutely hit the roof and, you know, go to the toilet and cry. But as you were saying, Fern, I think I've said this so many times on the podcast, I now see those moments of reflection, those moments of reflection for me to say, why did that get me so deep? You know, there's still obviously work that I need to do there. So if you can kind of use in that as a framework for reflection. And I just wanted to ask you as well, you mentioned getting support from school, and I think that's a really important thing. You know, I'd love to get your advice on, in terms of, you know, with the NPR and stuff, it sounds like it's really helpful within the home and creating that dynamic of trust and, that relationship that's strengthening for recovery. But obviously you're not, as you've mentioned, with your daughter 24/7. What sort of things or what sort of conversations did you have with school or ask for support with, so that you, I guess, you know, your daughter was still getting that support at school to help with her recovery?
Really, it was helpful to have Pam's intervention too, so they would meet with school with us as well, so that I could really come across. And we, for a while we had quite regular sort of monthly meetings to just check things over. But meal support at school has been a really big deal for us. So knowing that somebody's there and knowing it's the same few people that do that meal support each time. Honestly, having that understanding person. So we've been lucky enough now that we've got a few people that really understand, really care, and are able to protect my daughter from things that might happen in school that she doesn't really need to worry about. Because when you've got 20, 25 teachers, even if they know, they can't always be thinking about that one individual in the class. And if something happens that they then bring to this person that supports my daughter, that person can say, yeah, and then just deflect it for them and protect her from that. That's been the most helpful thing. So it's having one or two individuals in particular that you know care enough and you can have that immediate contact with. So it's called a key worker in her school, and that has just been invaluable. It's took a lot of working together, lots of conversations, lots of communication. And I think sometimes lots of, can I just tell you how hard it is right now for my child? So she can't be doing homework every night. She can't do an hour and a half's homework every night because she's in her head in that routine, and snacks take a long time. And you know, no, it's not okay to put that on her as well. So it's making sure those adaptations are made really around what happens in the school, but also then what they expect to happen at home. But having that one person or those two people has made a big difference.
Quite often at the beginning of this NPR journey, families come into this work and they feel quite lost, quite traumatised, quite overwhelmed by the work, you know, by the illness that they're managing really. And I was thinking that kind of through the process of doing the NPR, I think it reconnects you with the parent that you want to be, and you find your voice. And I think that then you're able to then find your voice
outside of your family setting. So you can then begin to think about, actually, I believe I know what's best for my child. And it gives you the confidence then to go and have other conversations with wider teams, And I think you've even had conversations with us in our family service to say, well, hold on a minute, I don't quite think she's ready for that. But I think it's the MVR that actually, we talk about this idea of MVR being a bit of a posture. So it's not leaning forward and shouting, nor is it being fearful and backing off. But it's actually about finding the middle ground and something that actually reconnects me with the parent that I want to be, the parent that I was before the illness set in. Because I think eating disorders have a really insidious way of eroding confidence. They, you know, parents are often feel like they don't know what to do for the best. And yet actually they've got their children to the age of 14, 15 with no major problems. But then suddenly this illness has come into their life and it's completely knocked their confidence massively. So I think sometimes the MVR process extends beyond and gives you the confidence then to have different kinds of conversations with school.
Yeah. Well, I think it allows you to be their biggest advocate, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And once you've taken the eating disorder out of the way so you can see your child more, you see all their strengths again, you know, you see all the wonderful things about them. And you can be that biggest advocate.
Because you reconnected in the relationship, aren't you?
Yeah.
That's the important bit, isn't it?
And Julie always talked about one of the things she really maintained was, what are the things that you used to do before the illness? What were the things that you enjoyed as a family before the illness? And for us, it was going out for meals and sitting down and watching theatre and cinema. And those things suddenly, and then you've just said, Hannah, because the eating disorders come out with you, it doesn't want to do those things necessarily, and they're the things that you stop doing. So it was about finding ways of reconnecting with those sort of childhood things. So reconnecting games that you used to play when they were little, and then finding new things to do as a family, really, that made a big difference so that you can see your child again.
Yeah. I think there's something really important about going back to the time before the illness came along. Because actually your child has often got a bank of really good memories. And developmentally, eating disorders kind of can halt development. So going back to a time when you were younger, when it felt simpler, when you were more successful, is often a really good place to go. It's a really good place to start, I think. Because eating disorders has this horrible habit of just sucking the fun out of life, isn't it?
It just makes things crazier,
yeah.
Yeah, serious and very depressing. And I love what you were saying about taking it back to your childhood, because that's exactly what I do if I'm struggling with something. I'm like, okay, what meal did I really enjoy as a kid? And you know, I don't know whether you have ever had them, but those like mini co-op pizzas, my grandma would always cook me one of them and put extra cheese and tomato ketchup on. So that's exactly what I do now. I'm like, okay, well, I'm struggling today, so I'm gonna get one of grandma's pizzas, I'm gonna put extra cheese and tomato ketchup on, and just it takes me back to being with her. And it's that comfort of your childhood before things had happened. And what you were just saying there, Fleur, about the cinema and theatre and stuff, I actually went to the cinema with my mum at the weekend to see Wicked. And before the eating disorder and stuff, we would always get like a Ben and Jerry's ice cream, or we'd share some popcorn or some sweets or whatever. And we have not done that probably for about 10 years. And when we went to see Wicked, Mum was like, oh, shall I grab some sweets? And in my head, I was like, oh, God, I know I need to say yes to this because that's what I should do, but I'm terrified. But I equally didn't want to say to her, I'm terrified. I was like, yeah, you go choose, which also made me very panic because she chose. And she texted me this morning saying, I just wanted to say, I didn't want to mention it, but the fact that we both kind of just helped ourselves to sweets at the cinema, which she said, I'm going to remember that for years, because it was so special to be able to do that with you again. So I'd really think that, you know, going back to those things that you did before the eating disorder, and obviously there's room for new things as well. Yeah. So the excitement now of, you know, I now go to the pub and I drink pints with my dad, which obviously I did not do pre-eating disorder because I was 10. But how nice now that I can go to the pub with my dad and not be like, oh yeah, just a vodka Diet Coke, please. You know, I'm having a pint and enjoying that with him. So I think that is, yeah, really special to think about the things that you used to do, but then also like future things that you can do together that just really allow you to connect, like you said.
The other thing that's just popped into my mind about what I remember from Fleur working with her before is that there was this idea that when the meal is over, families often just go their separate ways because it potentially has been a really stressful time. And so what we started to think about was how can you reconnect after the meal? It's that idea that when a meal is over, there's a potential there that it's been quite a stressful meal and that people will disconnect and go their own way. So one of the ideas around MVR was actually about how do you kind of reconnect when the meal is finished so that you're beginning to rebuild and reestablish relationships. But actually, your child might not want to. They might want to go off into their own space. And I think what Fleur was really good at was thinking about, actually, let's put a short programme on, let's put a film on, and actually inviting her daughter to come and join them and saying, you know, there's space on the sofa for you. I'd like you to come. There's space here for you.
And I've said it for a year, and she's still not joined me on the sofa. But and I say it every night. But having said that, she often will come into the room and talk to me about things. So what would happen is we'd be in totally separate spaces, and now she's coming in and joining us. So that change has happened. Yeah. You know, she doesn't want to watch the programme. Fair enough. But she is saying, I do want to be with you still. You know, that's important.
Yeah.
And I think, Juana, you asked me a question earlier, Hannah. You asked us a question about whether you kept any life of your own still. And I think one of the things about rebuilding those ideas of let's revisit childhood and let's make new memories as well was that I really wanted to model life to my daughter. And I called it something like Operation Seeking Joy or something like that. It was this idea we would go and do things together, and we started really simply. So we'd just go for a walk around a local park together because that was going to be a safe way to start having a conversation and having a chat just about normal things, not about eating disorders. And then it became something about, like, well, we both of us know nothing about art. So let's go and discover some art together. Let's go and see the local art galleries first. And, you know, no pressure because we only might be there for half an hour. But we've still got the journey to get there. We've got the time there and the time back. And all those things can be hard when you are struggling with sitting down or struggling with managing not being in your routines that might be created by the eating disorder. So showing life as and building new ideas and new activities together. And then also modelling me having life. So me going off for a day and doing something for me. So bizarre as it might sound, I did a day of yoga retreat, for example, which was just lovely and chilled and went with some friends. But knowing that actually mum is having a life, because it fills up my bucket. I've got more strength than when I come back. I've got more reserve. I'm able to manage my emotions, not go into fight and flight so quickly, all of those things. But I'm also saying this is life. These are the things that we do, you know, and I'm not going to let the eating sort of stop life happening. And I think that is really helpful.
And I think that connects to your question about how does MVR support self-compassion for a person with an eating disorder? And I think that if we go with this idea that we're our children's greatest teachers, what does your daughter see of you when you're then investing in yourself? You're teaching her a really important lesson that actually it's important to invest in yourself. So you kind of hope, don't you, that through showing self-care and self-compassion to yourself, then that's what you're teaching your children. Because they're watching it. Our children watch us all the time. Our children are like, know us so well. They're super scanners, aren't they? Mm-hmm. They know if we're not okay. And so for us to be okay means that they'll sit next to us and lean in. And I think that's what you've demonstrated as well in the MVR, that through self-care, through using the ideas, through really embracing the ideas, I think, that your daughter was then able to lean in.
You know what I really like as well is what you were saying there about, you know, showing like you live in your life and things like that. Is one thing I found so difficult was the eating disorder was such a big part of my life, and it was like people were just saying to me basically, you need to get rid of that. I'm like, okay, but please understand that I am going to have this massive black hole in my life because the eating disorder is impacting everything. And I think what you were saying there about, you know, showing your daughter, you know, going to see some art together, or seeing you do the yoga retreat, it shows people that there's a life beyond the eating disorder, mm. and that there are things that can bring you joy, can bring you happiness, and that can actually, you know, move into that space of where the eating disorder was. And that was such a key part of my recovery. It sounds so bougie, but my kind of one of the key moments of my recovery was going to Indonesia, which I know sounds really bougie, and I'm not saying that you need to go to Indonesia in order to have that transformative moment, but it made me realize that there is a world out there but beyond the eating disorder that I can have access to. But if I stay where I am right now, I'm not going to have access to that in the way that I want to. And I think that for me really opened my eyes up to be like, you know, I was seeing friends and stuff traveling, getting married, doing this and all these things that I wanted to do in my life. And I was just like, I'm not going to be able to do that if I stay where I am now. So I think absolutely, I think a lot of parents feel guilt when they do things for themselves. But actually, you're showing your child that there's a life beyond their eating disorder. The eating disorder isn't the core to their life. And that is something they can access, you know, if they do recover. So I think that is so important. Mm-hmm. And that's why I asked you the question about, you know, did you have a life outside of the eating disorder? Because it's something I always say to parents, please do not stop doing the things that you enjoy. Mm-hmm. Do not put your life on pause for the eating disorder. I know it's really hard because you want to be there for your child 24/7. But as you said at the start, Julie, you know, if you don't care for yourself, you cannot care for anybody else either.
And I think I like that idea that if you were to draw a circle and think about at the beginning of the illness, the circle is full of eating disorder, and actually life is probably just a very small segment of it. When you move towards recovery, what you hope is that actually the circle is full of life. And there's a small segment that is about food, because food continues to be part of life, doesn't it? Because we need food in order to continue. But actually, I think MVR helps us think about how do we put food back where it needs to be, so it's not so dominant. It's just a bit of life that we need it to be. That is about sustaining us, but it's also about enjoying it. Mm-hmm. Because it's okay to enjoy food, isn't it? That's a really important message, isn't it? It's okay to enjoy food.
It makes me think about the things that you could do, you know, reconciliation gestures that you could do. If you were thinking about how do I build my relationship with my child now who's going through this, and aware that we're coming up to Christmas and it's quite a stressful time. It's often really about food, isn't it? So thinking about actually keep the day as simple as possible would be my thinking, you know, keep things as normal as possible. So we flip our day. So we have our evening meal is our main Christmas meal, because that's when we'd normally have our evening meal. Mm-hmm. So we're not changing things too much. But also thinking about how in the run up to Christmas, how do you know that it's not all about this big day? This big day is not that big a deal. It's really about this connection between us as a family. And that's what we're celebrating. So things like sending your child a text message if they've got a phone, sending them a text message when you're not with them, just maybe a silly picture, maybe writing them a little note and sticking it in their pocket, just how much you love them, leaving a note on their desk. One of the things that we found the hardest as an MVR group was the fact that you might go and tidy your child's room or pick their clothes up and fold them. But these sort of acts of love that you're not expecting anything back from, you know, when you're at that parent that you suddenly feel like, oh, they should be able to pick their clothes up off the floor. But actually, this act of love of going in and just doing something kind for them, because actually their day is stressful enough, isn't it? They're going through enough to come home and see their pyjamas folded on the bed could just be them going, oh, mum's been in and mum cares about me. She's been thinking about me when I'm not there. And maybe when you pop out to the shops and you see a magazine, you might get them a magazine or whatever it is it might be, they're into lip balms, getting them a little lip balm, something like that. But just a tiny thing that says, I care about you and I'm here and I'm thinking about you all the time. And building those things up and then remembering to have your own self-care, because we get really busy at this time of year, don't we? We forget about ourselves when planning all of this. We put so much pressure on Christmas and actually going, do you know what, I'm going to have a day for me or an hour for me or 10 minutes of a walk in the sunshine for me, and putting yourself in that first position sometimes as well. So they would be my things. If you're going to think, how do I get started with MBR, you think about how to look after myself, how do I show my child that I'm thinking about them and caring for them at all those points? Because I tell you what, we've booked Wicked tickets for the cinema, so I've got my fingers crossed that, you know, because of the MBR, we're going to be able to go and we're going to be able to watch the cinema together and experience that. So it does make a big difference to your family. I think you can live with something really, really tough and you can think this has broken our family, but by using MBR, you can learn to live with something really tough and not just live, but actually really cherish each other and flourish in those moments and actually have a better relationship at the end of it because of it. So it is really powerful, and it isn't going to necessarily get rid of the eating disorder. It's going to help get rid of it, but it's going to help make sure that you've got that strong connection and that you help to fill, as Hannah, you described, that hole that's left. You know, actually this helps you fill that with all those things that are life and joy, and for me it's about making sure we find that joy.
And it's about relationships, isn't it? Because, you know, we're always going to be in relationships with our children, aren't we, with hate. And so actually, if we can strengthen and rebuild and reconnect, then why wouldn't you want to do that?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And thank you for bringing the aspect of Christmas in, Fleur, as well. I think that's really helpful, particularly given the time of year, for people to be thinking about that. And it just made me giggle as well, what you said about folding the laundry, because my mum, I have not lived at home for 6 years. And sometimes I'll go and stay at home for a week or something. And, you know, I'll put some of my washing in the washing basket. And she'll always say, oh, bloody hell, you're 27 and you're still bringing your washing home. But I always say to her, I have a distinct memory of coming back from uni once, and she said, please don't ever not bring me your washing, because I love doing that for you. So now I'm always like, ha, that is you, you get joy out of this woman. So I will always, so yeah, I really can resonate with that. But thank you both so much for sharing your experience and your time today, because I honestly think this is going to help people so much. So yeah, it's been really lovely to speak to you both, so thank you.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.